Welcome to the Baptist Joint Committee podcast. I'm Jordan Edwards, Communications Associate at the BJC. The 2015 Walter B. and K.W. Sheridan Lectures on Religious Liberty and Separation of Church and State were presented on the campuses of Mercer University in Macon and Atlanta, Georgia. This year's lecturer was Alan Brownstein, Professor Emeritus at the UC Davis School of Law. Here with me is Baptist Joint Committee Executive Director Brent Walker. Now, Brent, before the third Sheridan Lecture this year at the Mercer University Law School, you had a chance to meet with a handful of law students. Tell me what that exchange was like.
Well, the dean of the law school thought it would be helpful for me to meet with some students who were thinking about the possibility of practicing law in the public sector, maybe for non-profit organizations, rather than just going into a private practice law firm like most law students do. So the word was put out that I would be willing to meet with students with such interests and inclinations, and about a dozen showed up. It was really nice. We had a good conversation. I talked about, you know, my experience starting out in private practice and then going to seminary and feeling a call to ministry and to serving the cause of religious liberty and coming to the Baptist Joint Committee. So they were really interested in my story. But I talked to them about the advantages and disadvantages of practicing in the context of a nonprofit organization like the Baptist Joint Committee. Of course, there are many others and many that don't deal with religious liberty but are worthy spokespersons and outlets for ministry and for doing good. But it was really neat.
One thing that makes the Sheridan Lecture special is that speeches are delivered at different parts of the university.
One of the very interesting things about these lectures at Mercer is that we had the opportunity to give them in three different venues. We gave one at the Divinity School, one at the undergraduate school, and then one at the law school. That's just invaluable, particularly when you have a legal scholar like Professor Brownstein delivering the lectures. And it opened up a whole new audience at the law school and allowed him to focus in more specifically on two recent Supreme Court decisions dealing with religious liberty, no establishment, and free exercise. So, yes, whenever we're at a campus where there is a divinity school, a law school, and an undergraduate school, we try to divide it up. In fact, we did that last year at Baylor. We were able to go to Truett Seminary, to the undergraduate school, and to Baylor Law School. So we're always looking out for opportunities that way to spread the lectures around, to tailor them to various audiences in the university community, and we're going to continue doing that.
Thanks, Brent. Let's listen to the third of three Sheridan Lectures titled Liberty and Equality Values in the Hobby Lobby and Town of Greece Decisions.
Now, in this lecture, I'm going to discuss two important church-state cases that the Supreme Court decided last term, Borough versus Hobby Lobby and Town of Greece versus Galloway. Let me start with the Hobby Lobby case. To summarize the facts briefly, regulations promulgated pursuant to the Affordable Care Act arguably required employers to provide insurance coverage at no cost to their employees for various kinds of preventive care. And this preventive care included access to medical contraceptives. Plaintiffs, two closely held corporations, alleged that some of these contraceptives operated as abortifacients, and that the regulations requiring them to provide the insurance substantially burdened their religious beliefs by making them complicit in the distribution of abortifacients. Accordingly, plaintiffs argued that these regulations violated the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or RFRA, which prohibits the federal government from substantially burdening a person's religious exercise unless the government can justify doing so under strict scrutiny review. In a controversial 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court agreed with the plaintiffs that the challenged regulations violated RFRA. Now, basically, I believe the court reached the right conclusion in Hobby Lobby, but it made several serious mistakes in doing so. These mistakes undermined the persuasiveness of the court's opinion. They helped to provoke a political backlash, not only against the court's holding, but against religious liberty accommodations in general. And they increased the likelihood that the court's opinion will be read more broadly than necessary. The first issue the court considered was whether for-profit corporations are persons with a right to exercise religion protected by RFRA. Justice Alito begins his analysis, correctly I think, by focusing on the owners of the closely held corporations. The owners are natural persons with a right to exercise religion. RFRA protects their right to do so, protects their right to operate in business in a way that's consistent with their religious beliefs, even if they elect to do so in the form of a closely held corporation. The court should have stopped there and ruled in plaintiff's favor on that basis, without ever addressing the rights of corporations as independent entities. But the court didn't write that kind of limited opinion. Instead, Justice Alito asserted that a for-profit corporation itself is a person with a right to exercise religion protected by RFRA. I think that's a mistake. Now, to be fair, this isn't an easy issue to work through. The question of the religious liberty of institutions and its relationship to the religious liberty of the institution's members has been a challenging issue for American law and for church-state scholars since the colonial period. And this problem is complicated by our relative acceptance of the nonprofit religious corporation as a person for religious liberty purposes. But still, I think the court made a fundamental error when it suggested that artificial entities, divorced from the natural persons who own or control them, have religious exercise rights. Religious liberty is a dignitary right. It's predicated on a vision of what it means to be a natural person, a human being in a free society. Corporations don't have human dignitary rights because they're not human beings. They don't have a conscience. They don't experience guilt or shame. They don't love. They don't die. They will not stand in judgment before God. They were not created in God's image with inalienable rights. I think it's an offensive caricature of humanity to describe corporations as persons with dignitary rights. And if corporations can exercise religion as independent entities, exactly how do they go about doing that? What if the corporation's owners disagree on religious matters? Well, Justice Alito's answer to this question was that corporations have governing structures that allow them to reach all kinds of decisions, including whether or not to donate funds to philanthropic or political causes, or whether or not to engage in lobbying. Alito suggested that corporations can use those same structures to determine the corporation's religious exercise. But this answer opened the door to the argument that publicly traded corporations, as well as closely held corporations, can exercise religion and be protected by RFRA. Certainly, publicly traded corporations also have government structures that allow them to reach decisions about charitable donations, political contributions, and lobbying efforts. Justice Alito argued that it's unlikely that a publicly traded corporation would assert RFRA rights, but that hardly suggests that they're not entitled to do so. The court's corporations are persons analysis helped to provoke the significant political backlash that's been directed at this decision. In part, this is because many people reject the idea that corporations are persons with the same dignitary rights as real people. Perhaps more importantly, this analysis aligned the Hobby Lobby case with the court's highly unpopular decision in the Citizens United case, in which it held that corporations are persons for freedom of speech and campaign finance regulation purposes. Second critical issue the court confronted involved the question of whether the so-called contraceptive mandate substantially burdened the plaintiff's exercise of religion. Critics of Hobby Lobby's RFRA claim argued that there was no substantial burden here. The health insurance provided by the employer was simply a part of the employee's compensation package, just like the employee's salary. Whether the employee used her salary or her health insurance to have an abortion depended on the employee's independent choice. There was no reasonable basis for arguing that the employer who provided the health insurance was complicit with and morally responsible for the employee's health care decisions. Accordingly, requiring employers to provide the mandated insurance coverage could not substantially burden their religious opposition to abortion. The link between the insurance coverage and anyone's decision to have an abortion was just too attenuated to be the basis of a substantial burden claim. Furthermore, the substantial burden language in RFRA was intended to operate as a filtering screen to limit the scope of the statute. If plaintiffs can argue that they are complicit with any attenuated consequences of their conduct, this screening function would be eliminated, and RFRA would be essentially limitless in its application. The government would have to justify its regulations under strict scrutiny review whenever plaintiffs claimed that obeying the law would make it complicit with some hypothetical and speculative consequence. Now, the court rejected this argument and concluded that the challenged regulation substantially burdened the plaintiff's exercise of religion. As long as plaintiffs sincerely asserted that according to their religious beliefs, they would be complicit with sinful conduct if they provided the mandated health insurance, then they satisfied the prima facie requirements of a RFRA claim. And the court said, the courts have no business evaluating plaintiffs' beliefs about complicity to determine if they are flawed, poorly conceived, or unreasonable. I think the court's conclusion here is correct. The critics essentially arguing that plaintiffs' religious conclusions about complicity in this case can't be reasonably derived from their religious foundation, the belief that abortion is an egregious sin. But neither the government nor the courts can constitutionally evaluate the logic between religious premises and their conclusions. Interpreting scripture and interpreting its scope is the job of clergy and individuals. It's not the job of courts or government administrators. The critics of Hobby Lobby are correct, however, that this analysis significantly undermines the utility of the substantial burden requirement in operating as a filtering screen to limit the scope of RFRA, because the reach of complicity arguments can extend very far. But the substantial burden requirement would still filter out some claims. Some burdens would just be too slight to be recognized. And further, not all attenuated burdens can be grounded in a complicity argument. If an environmental regulation incidentally increased the cost of a product that was used in a religious ritual, a court might well conclude that the impact on religious exercise in that case was just too attenuated from the challenged government regulation to constitute a substantial burden. Well, if a government regulation substantially burdens a person's religious exercise, then under RFRA, the government must demonstrate that the challenged regulation is necessary to the furtherance of a compelling state interest. Does the government have a compelling state interest in enforcing the contraceptive mandate? The government asserted a compelling public health interest in requiring employers to provide insurance coverage for preventive medicine at no cost to their employees. While Justice Alito accepted the government's justification arguendo, he questioned whether the government really had a compelling interest here, because the preventive medicine requirements were phased in over time and there were exceptions to their application. I believe that Justice Alito's argument casting doubt on the government's compelling interest is wrong on the merits, and it was a strategic error as well. It's common for broad or new statutory frameworks serving important government goals to be phased in or to include exceptions. As the government argued to the court during oral argument, even Title VII's prohibition against race discrimination in hiring has exceptions to its application. Does that mean that the government lacks a compelling interest in eradicating racial discrimination in employment in our society? Moreover, Justice Alito's argument would apply not only to contraceptives that might be characterized as abortifacients, would also apply to all the other contraceptives and all of the other preventive tests and treatments which were required by the mandate. Justice Alito would, in essence, be arguing that the government lacks a compelling interest in making a range of preventive medical care available to workers who would otherwise have difficulty in affording such coverage. That contention is counterintuitive at best. And strategically, Justice Alito's argument about compelling state interest undercuts his claim that his opinion is narrow and limited in its scope. If every law that was phased in over time or contained exceptions to its application was held not to serve a compelling state interest, then an untenably large number of regulations would fail RFRA's strict scrutiny requirement. Moreover, Alito's suggestion that the government lacks a compelling interest in providing cost-free health insurance for contraceptives helped critics to cast this decision as part of an ideologically based war against women waged by conservative politicians and jurists. So if the mandate furthers a compelling state interest, are there less restrictive means available to the government to accomplish its goals? Put simply, is there a way for the government to accomplish its public health and gender equity goals without imposing so much of a burden on religious liberty? Because the court concluded that such less restrictive means exist, the contraceptive mandate was held to violate RFRA. Now, I think this is the strongest part of Justice Alito's analysis. The court explains that the government could fulfill its goal of protecting women's health without burdening religious liberty by expanding the accommodation it provided to religious nonprofit employers to include religious for-profit employers as well. Essentially, such an accommodation would shift the cost of the insurance coverage from employers to insurance companies. And under this approach, religious employers would not have to violate their beliefs, and female employees of religiously exempt employers would receive all of the benefits to which they were entitled under the mandate. Now, some critics have argued that this solution isn't as cost-free as the court suggested. There can be considerable lag time before less restrictive alternatives can actually be implemented in the real world. And that's a fair point. female employees of Hobby Lobby have still not received the insurance coverage that they were entitled to under the Affordable Care Act regulations. But on the court's facts, this is the paradigm example of a situation in which a religious exemption should be granted. If a law substantially burdens religious liberty, and religious objectors can be exempted from the law without imposing any cost on third parties or the general public, then the government should grant the requested exemption. This would be a win-win situation for both religious liberty and the government's interests. Now, Justice Alito also suggested that a more controversial, less restrictive means was available to the government. He said, if the provision of cost-free medical contraceptive coverage was so important, it was such a compelling state interest, then the government could accomplish its goal without burdening religious liberty by paying for the coverage itself out of the government's own resources, out of our tax dollars. Now, I don't challenge the idea that protecting rights under RFRA or protecting rights more generally may require the expenditure of public funds. Rights are often expensive political goods. And indeed, as a general matter, I think government should spread the cost or burden of protecting rights as widely as possible when it's able to do so. In an important sense, rights are public goods, and the cost of protecting them should be borne by the public at large, not by some narrow constituency. My primary criticism of Justice Alito's argument is that it provided no guidance for courts to use in determining when the cost of protecting rights would be unacceptably high. Perhaps the least persuasive and most disheartening part of Justice Alito's opinion is his attempt to convince the polity that his opinion is a narrow and limited one. He argued that other insurance cases, such as claims involving immunizations, might come out differently because they're justified by different compelling interests and may involve a different analysis of less restrictive alternatives. But pointing to different compelling interests in immunization cases does little to distinguish them from the court's reasoning and holding in Hobby Lobby. The court assumed in Hobby Lobby that the government did have a compelling interest in providing contraceptive insurance coverage, acknowledging that the government also has a compelling interest in providing insurance coverage for immunizations doesn't distinguish Hobby Lobby at all. In both cases, the compelling interest requirement of RFRA would be satisfied. The least restrictive means analysis might be more important in adjudicating other insurance cases, but Justice Alito doesn't explain why the same less restrictive alternatives that the court identified in Hobby Lobby wouldn't apply in an immunization case as well. Why couldn't the government shift the cost of insurance for immunizations from the employer to the insurance company? Why couldn't it pay for the cost of the insurance itself? Justice Alito's failure to meaningfully address these questions provides scant assurance to critics who are concerned about the scope of the Hobby Lobby decision. The court also responded to the dissent's concerns that an expansive interpretation of RFRA might require exemptions from anti-discrimination laws. These criticisms were unfounded, Justice Alito explained, because the government has a compelling interest in prohibiting racial discrimination in hiring, and Title VII's ban on race discrimination in hiring is precisely tailored to achieve that goal. Again, this is tepid assurance at best. It says nothing about RFRA claims challenging anti-discrimination laws protecting women, religious minorities, or gays and lesbians in the workplace. Nor does it say anything at all about RFRA claims challenging prohibitions against discrimination in places of public accommodation. The court also failed to explain why it believes that laws like Title VII, prohibiting racial discrimination in hiring, are sufficiently precisely tailored to serve a compelling interest. Why are the exceptions to Title VII acceptable, while the exceptions to the contraceptive mandate undermine the government's justifications for the regulations? Now, the court's failure here is particularly distressing because it's so obviously unnecessary. The court could have easily written a narrow opinion explaining why RFRA claims challenging the contraceptive mandate are entirely distinct from RFRA claims challenging civil rights laws. The contraceptive mandate involved payments for insurance coverage. This is a distinctly fungible benefit that could be easily, equally effectively provided by multiple sources: private employers, insurance companies, or the government itself. Anti-discrimination laws are very different. Here, there is the unavoidable psychological harm of being victimized by discrimination. Also, for example, if a woman is subject to discrimination in hiring by a religious employer who doesn't believe that women should work outside the home, the federal government has no obvious, feasible alternative means available to it to provide comparable employment opportunities to women subject to such discrimination in the community in which they live. Clearly, the least restrictive means analysis is much more problematic in cases involving civil rights laws than it was in Hobby Lobby. The court should have said that, and it didn't. So the court could have written a narrow opinion in the Hobby Lobby case. It failed to do so. And that failure, I believe, has contributed to the heated criticism the opinion has received, and has contributed to increased opposition to religious liberty exemptions in general. I have to drink some water before I go on to Town of Greece. Now let's turn to the Town of Greece decision. Let me be really blunt and honest and state at the outset that I think this is just a terrible decision. I can't think of anything positive to say about it. I'm not at all enamored with Justice Kagan's dissent either. The decision has to be pretty bad, or I don't like either the majority opinion or the dissent. For over a decade, the Town of Greece invited guest chaplains to offer state-sponsored prayers at the beginning of town board meetings. During this entire period, the town's prayer program almost completely ignored the religious equality and religious liberty values that are protected by the religion clauses of the First Amendment. And in Town of Greece versus Galloway, the majority of the Supreme Court upheld the town's prayer practices against an Establishment Clause challenge in an opinion that was equally dismissive of the religious liberty and equality principles that were at issue in this case. In my judgment, the religious liberty concerns here were glaring. At the beginning of board meetings, invited clergy asked residents attending the meeting to stand, bow their heads, and join in collective prayer. Plaintiffs claimed that this practice unconstitutionally coerced individuals to participate in a religious exercise. Their argument could hardly be more persuasive or more compelling. Put simply, when government officials are empowered to exercise discretionary authority over individuals, these officials, directly or through invited clergy, cannot request that individuals join the officials in prayer before a decision of importance to the individuals is reached. A judge can't ask attorneys and litigants to stand and join him or her in prayer before the trial begins. Or the government decision maker could be a public employer evaluating job applicants or determining promotions. It could be a teacher supervising and evaluating public school students. Or it could be a town board making administrative and legislative decisions involving small groups in the community, particular neighborhoods, or individual residents. In all of these examples, if the employer, the teacher, the judge, or the board, in their official capacity, asks citizens to pray, this request is intrinsically coercive. Citizens will naturally feel compelled to comply in order to avoid alienating government decision makers who have so much discretionary authority over the citizens' interests. And this kind of state coercion of religious exercise violates the First Amendment. Then the court's first response to this argument is to characterize the town's practice as legislative prayer. Then the court explains that there's a long tradition of Congress and state legislatures beginning their sessions with state-sponsored prayers. The court recognized this historical tradition and upheld these legislative prayers in a case called Marsh versus Chambers in 1983. In Town of Greece, the court argued that the analysis and holding of Marsh is controlling, and it required upholding state-sponsored prayers at the beginning of town board meetings. But the Marsh decision and a tradition of state-sponsored prayers before Congress and state legislatures has little relevance to religious coercion claims directed at local government bodies. The Marsh decision didn't focus on the coercion of members of the public viewing sessions of the state legislature or Congress from the visitor's gallery. There wasn't any reason for it to do so. The prayers offered by the Nebraska legislature that were upheld in Marsh were internal matters that were directed to the legislators themselves, not to the public. More importantly, visitors in the gallery of state legislative sessions are there as passive, anonymous observers. Legislators are rarely aware of their identity or their presence, and there is no interaction between the public and decision makers. The situation is entirely different when prayers are offered at a small town board meeting. Here, the meeting rooms are small, much smaller than this room. Few residents are in attendance, far fewer people than are in this room. The audience sits in close proximity to the board, first couple of rows. And the audience is very visible to the board members. This is not anonymous seating in a legislative gallery. And the citizens who attend town board meetings are not there as passive observers. Nobody goes to a town board meeting just for entertainment purposes, just to see what it's like. They attend board meetings to participate in government, by speaking to the board during public comment periods. Their goal is to influence board members. Their goal is to petition their government. And further, while state legislatures and Congress typically enact general laws impacting very large groups of constituencies, town boards regularly deal with issues affecting small groups, neighborhoods, even particular individuals. The problems addressed and the limited number of stakeholders make these decisions distinctly personal to those residents whose interests are at issue. Because of these differences, the decision in Marsh tells us very, very little about the coercive nature of government-sponsored prayer at town board meetings. In this latter context, citizens are coerced when they are asked to stand or otherwise affirm a prayer that is being offered in their name. Failure to comply would risk alienating the very political decision makers who they hope to influence. Now, the court responded to these arguments by denying that the town of Greece's prayer practices were coercive. In defending that conclusion, Justice Kennedy interprets social reality in a way that's very difficult for me to accept. In fact, it's very difficult for me to even understand. First, Justice Kennedy argued that the principal audience of the prayers offered by guest chaplains wasn't the public, it was the town board itself. That contention makes no sense. Guest chaplain at a meeting stands with his back to the board, faces the audience of town residents, like I'm facing you. He asks the audience to stand, bow their heads, and join him in prayer. The audience responds by doing so. The chaplain often offers the prayer in the name of the public audience. But Justice Kennedy insists that the prayers were directed at the board members who were sitting behind the chaplain and not to the public audience he was so obviously addressing. Next, Kennedy argued that the prayer practice wasn't coercive because no one would notice if a dissenter left the room when the prayer starts. And even if they did notice his departure, no one would be offended by his conduct. Now, I've been to lots of local government meetings, and Kennedy's description is bewilderingly wrong. The audience at these meetings is often so small that it would be impossible to fail to notice when someone left the room when a prayer was offered. And any normal person would worry that if they left the meeting when a prayer was offered, or when people were asked to stand for the Pledge of Allegiance or for the national anthem, that both the board and the audience would be offended by their conduct. Kennedy also maintained that if a person stands when the prayer is offered, no one would perceive their conduct to suggest participation in the religious exercise or agreement with its content. Again, that conclusion simply makes no sense to me at all. People aren't always asked to stand when prayers are offered. And when they are asked to stand, most people feel that doing so has religious meaning. Why would anyone doubt that such conduct suggests participation and acquiescence in the religious exercise? Moreover, for religion clause purposes, the public's perception of a person standing while a prayer is offered is only part of the analysis. Equally, if not more important, is what the person standing understands this conduct to mean. For many people, standing while a prayer is expressed constitutes the exercise of religion. In many faith traditions, prayer involves more than words. Physical movements and posture play an important role in the act of worship. Standing is a particularly meaningful posture for prayer in many religions and would be understood to be part of a religious exercise. When a person is required to stand while a prayer is recited, they are compelled to engage in a religious exercise, and coercing religious exercise violates the Constitution. Then a town's prayer practices also violated religious equality principles. Since I want to allow some time for responses and for Q&A, I'm just going to discuss a few of these concerns, but that doesn't mean that the concerns I'm going to describe are my only problems with the opinion. There are plenty of other equality concerns that I won't have time to get to. Virtually all of the clergy invited to offer prayers were Christians affiliated with organized religious congregations in the community. A majority of the prayers offered were explicitly sectarian in content. The prayers were typically offered on behalf of the audience in the community, not as an expression of the prayer offerer's personal beliefs. Both the selection process through which individuals were invited to offer prayers and the content of the prayers they expressed undercut or violated religious equality principles. Non-Christians lived in the town of Greece. Jewish residents worshiped in synagogues in adjoining communities. Buddhists and members of the Baha'i faith lived in Greece as well. And surely, as is true throughout America, some people living in the town held spiritual beliefs but did not affiliate with any organized religious congregation. But only Christian clergy from organized congregations, with rare exceptions, were invited to offer prayers at meetings. To put it bluntly, the town's invitation process treated non-Christian and non-affiliated residents as if they didn't exist or were unworthy of notice. The court's responses to this challenge are not only unpersuasive, they're a virtual recipe for religious discrimination. First, the court argued that the town didn't need to go outside its borders to invite guest chaplains to offer prayers at town board meetings. Second, it claimed that the low-level functionaries charged with issuing invitations to offer prayers without any guidance at all may have been inept in doing so, but it's not unconstitutional to be inept and incompetent. And the court said plaintiffs admitted that they couldn't prove intentional discrimination against religious minorities. Third, since the board insisted that it would have allowed people of any faith and no faith to offer the invocation at meetings, they had only asked to be invited to do so, the court said that obviously there's no discrimination in this case. Anyone of any faith or no faith could have been invited to offer these prayers. Now, these myopic answers not only shield discrimination against religious minorities from constitutional review, they provide a blueprint of how to do this. Outside of big cities, it's common for religious minorities to establish a congregation and a house of worship in one town in order to serve the spiritual needs of adherents who live in neighboring communities. Under the court's analysis, minorities who worship in adjoining communities need never be invited to participate in public prayer programs. Never. The court's attempt to blame the town's decisions on the incompetence of low-level staff is even more disturbing. When constitutional rights and values are at issue, the courts have emphatically demanded that the government operate under carefully structured and transparent guidelines to limit the risk of biased decision making. Leaving decisions to inadequately guided petty functionaries has always been considered a constitutional problem, not a shield for discriminatory results. Vesting discretion in unsupervised staff in these situations virtually invites discrimination. And the absence of guidelines makes it difficult for a court or aggrieved parties to determine when discrimination occurs. That's why in free speech cases, for example, courts insist that permit decisions must be governed by clear published guidelines. Confronted with an ad hoc process, it's no surprise that the plaintiffs in town of Greece elected not to pursue their claims of deliberate discrimination. And most bizarre of all is the court's reliance on the town's purported policy of adding anyone who asked to be included to the list of guest chaplain invitees. The list was open to everyone. But this policy wasn't published anywhere or announced to anyone. Now, how can a selection process not be discriminatory if organized Christian congregations are invited to offer prayers and non-Christian minorities and non-affiliated residents are supposed to guess that they could invite themselves to do so? The content of the prayers offered also raised equality concerns. Collective we prayers that purport to speak for everyone in the audience or the community inaccurately presume religious homogeneity and ignore religious differences. Combined with the town's discriminatory selection process in town of Greece, such prayers reinforce the town's failure to recognize the existence or worth of non-Christian residents in the community. The majority opinion in town of Greece is a terrible decision for anyone who cares about religious liberty and religious equality. We can only hope that it's given a narrow interpretation in future cases. Now, I mentioned at the beginning of my discussion of Town of Greece that I wasn't enamored with Justice Kagan's dissenting opinion in this case either. But let me clear that I consider Justice Kagan's dissent to be vastly superior to Justice Kennedy's majority opinion. However, there is something inexplicably missing in Justice Kagan's criticism of the Town of Greece's prayer practices. To Justice Kagan, the constitutional problem with the state-sponsored prayers in Town of Greece relates exclusively to religious equality concerns. He says almost nothing about coercion and the impact of coercive prayer practices on religious liberty. And her failure to discuss coercion and religious liberty is particularly odd in that many of the powerful examples she uses to illustrate her arguments are so obviously coercive in nature. Justice Kagan argues, for example, that it would violate the Establishment Clause if the presiding judge, immediately prior to trial, asked a minister to come forward to invite the attorneys and litigants to rise and join him in prayer. She eloquently insists that an individual seeking benefits or services from the government or seeking to influence government decision makers can't be asked to pray before government officials or a member of the clergy invited them to offer a state-sponsored prayer. But Justice Kagan never takes the next step to argue that the problem with such prayers is that they are coercive in nature and abridge religious liberty. Instead, she describes the problem entirely in religious equality terms. Individuals asked to pray in these situations must either subordinate their beliefs or publicly set themselves apart from the majority on religious grounds. These prayers are constitutionally invalid because they operate as an instrument for dividing religious minorities from adherence to the community's majority religion. The problem with Town of Greece for Justice Kagan is that sectarian prayers offered by clergy selected through a discriminatory invitation process in the context of a small town board meetings align the state with a particular religious creed. Now, I agree with Justice Kagan that the Establishment Clause requires more respect for religious equality than the town board in Greece offered. But in my judgment, Town of Greece is also a religious liberty case, raising very serious concerns about religious coercion. And Justice Kagan's dissent doesn't address that issue directly at all. And that's why I have a problem with it. Thank you.
That was Professor Alan Brownstein delivering the Walter B. and K.W. Sheridan Lectures on Religious Liberty and Separation of Church and State, recorded live at Mercer University. Thanks for listening to the Baptist Joint Committee podcast. For more on the Sheridan Lectures, including videos of this and previous year's presentations, visit bjconline.org/lectures. For more podcasts, go to bjconline.org/podcasts.